Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Pete Gooding, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, Matt Rouse, the Managing Editor at House Culture. To our loyal listeners, welcome back, and to those just joining us, a hearty welcome indeed. What a delight it is to have you on board. Everyone, prepare yourself, for we are about to embark on a fantastic voyage as we enter our fifth season. And it's not just your auditory senses that are in for a treat. Now you can witness all of these interviews unfold on our YouTube channel. So make sure you show us some love and subscribe over there at youtube.com/@housecultureNet. Those that are unacquainted with what we do on the House Culture Podcast can dig through our archive of over 60 episodes that feature guests from the entire spectrum of electronic music. Not only are there chats with megastars of the scene such as Paul Oakenfold, Fatboy Slim, Todd Terry and Roger Sanchez, I'm guessing if you clicked on this one, you'd also be interested to hear our conversations with other masters of the Balearic beat, like John Satrencher, Fat Phil Cooper, and Sally Rogers from A Man Called Adam. Dive into that treasure trove of episodes and revel in their insights. As I mentioned, we've expanded into the visual realm, so I urge you to subscribe to our YouTube channel and join the festivities on our home over on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, where over 300,000 passionate party enthusiasts are already congregated. Don't miss out on the excitement. Check the links in the episode description to secure your place on our coveted guest list and stay abreast of all things house culture. Let's continue with this fifth season, as in this episode we sat down with someone whose decade-long residency at Café Mambo cemented their position as a true Sultan of the Sunset. Now this is someone who not only plays all over the island of Ibiza, but also lives there as well. It's the wonderful Pete Gooding. In our chat, you'll hear how young Pete familiarised himself with what was going on in late 80s Ibiza.
The key thing that changed was 1989. We went back to Ibiza on a family holiday. My sister Emma put LSD in my mouth and my brother's mouth, and she took us to Amnesia and Desparadis, and I heard Alfredo play French Kiss. Again, I'm not going to pretend I understood more than I did. I just loved what I saw. It was very alien to me and I loved it. I remember thinking, like, whatever this is, I want to be around this.
He tells us about his hilarious first meeting with the legendary Jose Padilla.
We went back to Café Del Mar. I think I'd read in Mix Mag something about Jose. But I went up to him and in my terrible Birmingham accent, he said, "I've been reading in Mixmag, there's a bloke called Jose that plays here. Can I buy one of his tapes?" Because it was a thing, you know. And he just laughed at me and said, "Well, there's nobody here called Jose, but you can have one of mine." And I walked off and thought, is he taking the piss? It says Jose. I was thinking, whatever. But this tape was for me like listening to Sasha tapes. It was like equally as impactful and I guess informed everything really since.
And how he maintains his passion for music.
Every time I have a gap between meetings, I'm often discovering music, buying records. I am as obsessed now in discovering music as I ever have been. And then I have beautiful places to go and play it, you know. It's just, I can drive half an hour and play at La Torre or The Standard or Pikes or wherever.
I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. This is Pete Gooding.
House Culture.
Hi Pete, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us on the House Culture podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you here. You've been serenading audiences with your sunset sets for many years in Ibiza, whether that's having been the maestro of Mambo or the musical director at your current home of Hostel La Torre. We want to talk about how you got to where you are today. However, we want to roll it back to the beginning and find out about your musical education as a young man growing up in Solihull.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
So musically, I guess, I mean, the first thing I ever bought was a Nick Kershaw album on a cassette. Mm-hmm. And I think I had for Christmas, I think it was 1980, so I was seven. I had a little cassette recorder. And mm-hmm. I think I had, was it Nick Kershaw, The Riddle, I believe, was the album.
Yeah,
and I listened to it a lot. I guess that was the beginning of not being obsessed with music, but liking music. And then I had an older sister who was really, obviously, she was 2 years older than me, and she was more really, really into music. And so I would hear stuff from her. And then I recall it was about 1986. I was doing, she came to my room and gave me a cassette tape to listen to, which was The House Sound of Chicago, Volume 1, which was a Pete Tong compilation on FFRR, which had like Mr. Fingers, Can You Feel It, these kind of the early sort of tracks and DJ International releases.
Yeah.
And what this did was, it was Marcel Jefferson, Music is the Key, and Mr. Fingers, Can You Feel It. I repetitively listened to them, and I became really quite obsessed with those particular tracks. I mean, I liked everything that was there, but of course, I'd never heard anything like that. And I wasn't old enough to have been actively going out in that era or the electro era that had happened just before. Mm-hmm. So I was discovering this in my bedroom, you know, doing my homework. And not that I ever did any homework. Well, I don't think I did any after that point was the problem. so that really got me very interested. And then...
So how old were you? How old were you at that point when your sister gave you that tape?
About 13, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, I was probably equally as interested in Dungeons and Dragons still at that point. You know, not exactly rock and roll. I think that was when the switch came. But I think I probably bought a Public Enemy album around that period. Maybe it was a year later. Nations and Millions to Hold Us Back. Again, I was obsessed with that album massively. I think I owned a Bon Jovi album and a Def Leppard album. Like I wasn't, it was quite mixed. But but a holiday to Ibiza, which was just a family holiday. My parents had been there, I think in 1985 on a holiday. And then they took us there in 1987, which again, I was still very young. I was 14.
Yeah.
So, but what was really significant, we met some kind of really... some other kids in the hotel, and they were really into music and my sister's age. And there was a cassette tape of that. That's like, was the, I guess the soundtrack of that holiday. And there were things like, Loose Ends Hanging on a String.
Mm-hmm.
Those, that kind of, you know, UK soul, street soul that was obviously big at the time. And I think the other side was a lot of house stuff that I'd been obviously familiar with. And I really enjoyed that. And it was another sort of style of music I'd not encountered. But then what I did do was go to the hotel disco. And bizarrely, I know who the DJ is now. He's someone
That's brilliant.
It's a guy called Lolo, who was a local DJ here in Ibiza, who was, I believe, was also a resident at Es Paradis at that time. But of course, I wasn't going there. So hotel disco, I heard two records that really stood out to me. And my mom took me to a record shop, which was in the school. We were staying in a hotel called the Tannet near Calagrasio.
Yeah.
And there was a shop kind of up, there's a little square not far from the end of the road where Mambo is. And there was a record shop there. I don't even remember what it was called now. Mm. And I bought these two records. One was Sven Vath's first record, Electric Salsa, the one he raps on, Off is the name of the band.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which I love.
Yeah.
And Jungle Fever. I always forget how to pronounce the artist, but Kachakas or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just not heard anything like these. And there was a very foreign, exotic sound to these records. They were both in foreign languages. I'd not heard any music that was. And there was those sort of synths in the electric styles, a very Euro newbie early. Yeah. Again, I wouldn't have known that at the time, but and I became really into newbie actually after that record. And I still play that record. But so that hooked me more on this exotic thing and falling in love, I guess, with Ibiza. And then going home after that, I think I bought a MIDI hi-fi, you know, like a Sanyo.
Yeah.
What was the shop that, that was from? Whatever the main
Dixon.
So my sister had one and I had one. Mm-hmm. And I knew nothing about DJ culture one bit, but when she was out, I'd put both in the same room.
Yeah.
And I used to play a record on one and I would record it. And then I'd, without any awareness of this, I would be counting to the end of a bar and press pause. Then I'd get a different record on either the other one or swap the tape over, and I'd wait for an appropriate end of a bar loop as if I was subconsciously moving the crossfader across, and I'd kind of make these one deck tapes. I don't know where I wasn't inspired by a Greg Wilson. I didn't know anything about the culture. So I was playing around with that a lot because my sister had a few records and I had like and then my sister was listening to PCRL, which was a radio station in Birmingham that was a pirate, I think. Playing a lot of, again, that sort of street soul and an early house.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess time passed on. I remember really loving a lot of records that were in the charts around that time, like, you know, Blue Monday, Small Town Boy, Depeche Mode records, really loving that as well.
Yeah.
Yazoo records, you know, just anything emotive I loved. And and then... Actually, Small Town Boy is still a major favorite. I just love that record.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. And then the key thing that changed was 1989. We went back to Ibiza on a family holiday. I've told this story. It makes my mother cringe. But my sister Emma put LSD in my mouth and my brother's mouth.
Oh, my God.
In a bar in the West End. And took us
how old were you at this point in 89?
15.
Wow.
15, I would say.
Yeah.
And she took us to Amnesia and Desparadis. And
amazing.
I heard Alfredo play French Kiss and I was just like, you know, it was open air. I remember it raining and it's like, and I just, this sort of amazingly foreign, again, exotic place with people of all ages that look super interesting. And again, I'm not going to pretend I understood more than I did. I just loved what I saw. It was very alien to me and I loved it. And I remember thinking like, whatever this is, I want to be around this. And I wouldn't have said that to anyone. I just have a very strong feeling I had. And S Paradise was great in that era.
Mm.
You know, records like Korea, Baby Let Me Love You, and
crazy
stuff. Like at the end of the night, the DJ would play Singing in the Rain and they would move all the cushions. This guy would come and sweep the floor super quick, throw the cushions onto the roof, and you would dance under the stars in a waterfall. It was like that wasn't happening anywhere else. But of course, I'd never been to a club before. This was my first experience in a club.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I go home from that and we start going to a club my sister's already aware of called the Hummingbird in Birmingham, which was like, you know, for me was, well, it was the place at that, in that era. So this was autumn 89.
Yeah.
DJs like Lee Fisher and Jock and, I mean, there were lots, you know, there were a lot, Neil Macy, I'm trying to think who else would have been there. John from Tempest Records was also one of the. So there's a lot of these kind of local DJs that were really good. Lee Fisher, especially, was a big influence. He was fantastic. And again, hearing these sort of records, Frankie Knuckles, Your Love, Strings of Life. It was that era, Pacific State, you know, great records. And just you walked in and the heat hit you. You were instantly soaking wet. Obviously, we were just discovering ecstasy and it was like, fucking mind-blowing, you know, a really incredible and a great time. You know, there was a lot of illegal raves starting in Birmingham because they weren't there as early as down in London.
Yeah.
But we would be driving in these convoys, as it, you know, everybody knows about. Yeah. And there was just amazing sense of unity and togetherness. And I'm sure the drugs helped, but there really was, there was no VIP area. There was no, I'm on the guest list. It was the opposite. And I didn't know any different, but it was wonderful. And we would drive all around the Midlands, lots of things in like warehouses in Coventry. Amnesia House, I believe, was putting on a lot of those events. So that exploded, and that was the beginning of that culture in that area, and it was really exciting. I started then buying records. I became a glass collector in the local pub, and I would earn enough money to buy about 4 imports. I'd go to a shop called Don Christie's, another one called Summit, the Chart Shop, these shops around Birmingham, and start buying these records. And I actually missed my final business studies exam to buy Frankie Knuckles Your Love, because Don Christie's were now. We're getting like 5, and he promised to keep me one.
Well, that's a good reason to miss it, yeah.
Absolutely. It panned out right. It was a good choice looking back. I didn't know that at the time, and nor did my mother. So, you know, I'm obsessively buying records. I think I've bought some belt drive turntables because I can't afford I've got Technics decks, but they're much cheaper ones, essentially with an elastic band holding the thing on. So learning to mix on those was a challenge because
absolutely
you were moving them in live in real time to keep. And then, of course, that sounds horrendous. So you get quite, you've got to really focus. So, and then I guess that, again, we went to Ibiza in 1990. It wasn't all new to me at this point. And Amnesia was the music was quite different in 1990. It was a lot of that sort of Italian FBI project, those kind of really uplifting feel good records. And again, pairing that with those Dennis the Menace ecstasy stuff, you had a beautiful combination and the sunshine, you know, you're in Ibiza. And so that was really incredible that year. But then, and I guess I would be nearly 17, I guess, at this point. So,
and you were still, so when you were going back in these, in 90, that was still with your parents and your older sister?
No, actually, 1990 was the first time that I didn't need to go with my parents. I think I went with my brother and my sister and my sister's boyfriend, Chris. So we were buying lots of records there, going to all the clubs, going to Koo, and didn't go to Pasha actually. I hadn't been to Pasha at that point. But I think Space and Koo and Summit actually was really good. I think in the Bay in San Ana, there was some good stuff happening there, I recall. So, but getting much more integrated into what was going on, making lots of friends, meeting people, going to Café Del Mar. I mean, it was before Jose played there because he didn't come till 91, but loving the music and, you know, and of course the view, and it was the place to go after you before you went out. So, you know, enjoying that, but again, loving the atmosphere, but not something obviously much bigger happened when Jose was there for me. But you know, it was fantastic. And I think after going home from that holiday, the Hummingbird was still going, but, you know, there was a lot of people locally were talking about this new DJ that was like the best DJ they'd ever heard. He was playing in a club in Stoke, which was Sasha.
Yeah.
So we were like, let's go and check this out. And it was Shelley's. And that was like a whole nother level for me. I mean, that was, I went on to become really good friends with Dave Seaman, actually, who played there. And I've managed Dave as well. So we've sort of talked about it a lot. And, you know, again, walked in, instant sweat box, intense atmosphere.
Yeah.
The drugs were great at that time and the music was phenomenal. And I think that's why I wanted to become a DJ. I never thought I would be a DJ until I heard Sasha. And I don't believe I ever thought I would be as good as Sasha, but I was so inspired by how much better he was than everyone else.
Yeah.
That I just never heard. It felt like he really understood the mood of the music, you know, a different level to anybody. And that I was like, I want to do this. And that's when I bought my proper Technics and 10 hours a day learning to mix. You know, that's what hooked me. And that was my initial route to making those choices, I guess, looking back.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, you know, there's a lot to unpack from that. I mean, it's unreal that you were, you know, rudimentarily trying to create your own DJ mix.
It's quite bizarre because I had nothing triggering that.
Yeah. And, you know, so even to the point where you hadn't actually even really seen a DJ play.
No, I had utterly no awareness of, you know, you can't always remember the past as well as you think you do. My sister may have had more, it's not a conversation I've ever discussed, but she may have had more awareness of that. But people I've done a lot of work with in my life, somebody like Phil Doherty, who went on to become Future Shock, he's older than me, and he was really a big fan of Greg Wilson from his earliest days.
Yeah.
And was really into hip hop and electro and the sort of birth of DJ culture. I didn't see it. I was at school. I was 10 years old. You know, I was playing with Lego. I wasn't around, you know, just playing with no reason. It's like when I see my daughter, you know, playing, it's just, you just take it wherever you want to go. Yeah. I guess I was just playing around with it.
Yeah.
With no reason. As I mean, I'm sure they sounded horrendous, but it's quite fun that it's almost like trying to DJ before you know what DJing is. I was just enjoying the sounds they made and just playing around.
Just messing around. And, you know, and we talk about Shelley's and Sasha. We on the podcast, we have spoken to Dave Seaman and we've interviewed Dave Ralph. And, you know, they've got their stories of seeing Sasha for the first time. And when we spoke to Steve Lawler as well, he was very much like you've just said, that elevation of DJing as an art form. It wasn't just someone playing records. It was some really understanding key and mood and acapellas and tricks and doubling up beats and just taking it to another level. And, you know, how inspirational that
was. I know hip hop. I guess there was a culture of understanding that, but I wasn't part of that. Yeah. So as fantastic as other DJs were, for me, mixing was how they got to the next record. It was something you needed to do to get, was what I remember very clearly after sort of being at raves and stuff, and always there would be a Sasha tape on at your mate's house as everybody's sort of coming down essentially. Uh-huh. And just, I remember studying them and thinking, when he puts that a cappella over that track, it sounds as good as if it was the song that was written for that track. But I didn't know it was in key.
Yeah.
At the time, I was just like, it's like magic. How's he doing it? No one else is doing this. And I've always loved intensely atmospheric, melancholy music. And there was a very strong, even before Sasha was playing progressive stuff, there were still those records in there like Sean Christopher, Another Sleepless Night, the Red Zone Dub and Techno Burt, New Dimension, that were very trippy and weird. And I've always been drawn to that, and he could create a mood.
Yeah.
And he'd come on again with an intro thing and you'd be like, wow, no one does this. Like it was a very different level to other people. And I still would say he was for me, the best DJ ever, you know, in that respect. I actually had Sasha came and did a sunset for me at La Torre in 2019. And it was incredible. I have to say, it was really good. Like, I knew he would, of course, adapt and be fantastic and, you know, get it right, obviously. And it was really, really special, actually. Yeah, really good.
Oh, he's such a special talent. So you've got yourself the inspiration to become a DJ. You know, you've got the record collection. You're obsessive about this stuff now. You know, what kind of point were you starting to get gigs? Was it in the UK, or did you think, I need to go out there and take all my tunes out to Ibiza and make an impact?
I was very clear I was going to spend my life doing something I loved from a very young age. I've never doubted that. I was never getting a job. I mean, I couldn't have got one. I failed all my exams because I didn't care anymore. Once the music obsession, I was pretty relatively academic until that moment. And then just, I didn't care. I know, I don't recall ever doing homework. I just didn't care. Yeah. But I think from that point, I don't think I was ever, DJing wasn't a career back then.
Mm-hmm.
So not like, you know, I manage artists now. I can have a conversation with the new artist who can see a future and a plan and almost a path.
Yeah.
That path wasn't there. DJs didn't have managers in the 80s and the early, like they didn't, the infrastructure wasn't even there. So I didn't, it was like a hobby. It wasn't something I saw myself doing as a job, you know, I mean, because I couldn't see that there was a path there.
Yeah.
So I guess, let me think of the timeline. I left school in 1990, I guess. And then I think me and Steve Lawler and one of our best friends, Washington, another guy called Mark Armstrong, we went and DJed. We put a little thing on for our mates. I don't remember the details, but it was like in the function room of a pub in a village near it. Was it Marston Green? I forget even the name. I'm rarely ever there, but and I think it was called the George in the Tree. And, you know, I have a memory of, I guess, pretending I was Sasha and playing Moby Go with an out of key, out of time a cappella, having no awareness it was probably even out of time or out of key, thinking how fantastic it was to like four of our friends who'd bothered coming. but if there was ever fun stuff in someone's house, I guess I had a box of records and everybody liked them. Mm. And I think that led to one of my best friends, Greg, was in a small village near where we live called Knoll. And the guy that ran a local wine bar said, oh, our DJ's just cancelled. He was just walking down the road past him.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, Pete's got some records. You know, he's not a DJ, but book him, we'll come and listen. So I ended up being a mobile DJ to this like wine bar.
Mm.
And I drove to Coventry to collect a sound system, which I hired. Then I would set it up. Sometimes couldn't even get it to work because I just didn't know what I was doing.
Mm.
And then I would DJ for 6 hours, take it down,
yeah,
drive it back. And I think it cost me about a tenner more than I got paid. And I was overjoyed.
Uh-huh.
And I loved it. Like, yeah. I really enjoyed sharing music. I enjoy, you know, I loved. And at the same time, the guy I'd been collecting glasses for took over the local club, the only club in Solihull.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested I wanted to start a student night because I knew everybody in my town. I had friends in every school, actually. I guess my sister went to a different school and I was always very sociable. So I was sort of connected and outgoing. And I felt that Tuesdays were historically a busy night in Solihull. And I thought, you know, I can get everybody out of all the other pubs and into the one where we are. I felt like, yeah, that would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the boss just introduced me to a chap that was DJing already there, who was older than me, called Phil Doherty. And Phil's a great DJ. I think he came like third in the DMC in the local heat in like 87, and was running a studio and a record label. And we chatted and got on really well, and we decided we would do it together. And it was within 3 weeks we were getting 500 people in the bar, bringing out an extra sound system, and it had a really good atmosphere.
Yeah.
And all the people that were going to the raves that were locally and a little bit older and a little bit younger were coming. It was quite a meeting point for that town. And it was a big deal for me. Obviously, it was, you know, if you want a gig, I didn't see that someone would book me. I would put the gig on. Didn't see any other way. And, you know, we'd print the flyers, design the flyers. I'd hand them out till 3-4 in the morning, 3 nights a week with my first girlfriend, Hannah. And, you know, we'd have a little technique. If it was random, there was a queue, I'd walk Murillo past the queue. If it was quiet, I'd take him in the back door, you know, and wait till it was busy. And, you know, I got 35 quid a week. I was overjoyed, you know.
Yeah.
And this, I think it was the most, I mean, it really grew. And we started in the small club above it afterwards, and that held 400. Then we outgrew that and went to the big room, which was 800. Then it was both of them. And we, you know, back in the beginning of the 90s, booking, you know, Tony Humphries, Murillo,
yeah,
I guess Graham Park. I mean, the list, we booked everybody. I mean, Ashley Beadle, everybody. And it was great. It was great fun. And it attracted a lot of attention from people I didn't know at the time, but of course know now. But like the guys from Moneypenny's and the Steering Wheel and the guys who own Global Grooves, they were all sort of, I guess, thinking it was a busy night in Solihull. We didn't know about this place.
Yeah.
So, and that led to getting other work, because I think Ansell's Brewery was their most busy night of the in the whole country,
right?
And basically they had a great venue in Birmingham called Raphael's, which was super popular.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have DJ, so they literally handed that to me and Phil, and that was like the place to go in Birmingham before you went to a club. So again, it was a great thing. So it just, you know, and that one thing led to another, and you know, you're meeting people. But actually Steve Lawler would taken a job at Global Grooves, which was, I guess, the local record shop in Birmingham. And I'd failed all my exams, and I'd repeated them and failed them and repeated them and failed them and repeated them and failed them. And I think, again, my first girlfriend probably cheated and did some of my coursework, and I think I passed a couple of them.
Yeah.
And was still, I suppose I knew what I wanted to do. I was pretending on the one hand I could be academic and actually pass some exams and have a job. But I think it was the only time I ever really made a brave decision, was I think I was in my head, I remember thinking, if I do both, I've got an excuse for the other failing. Oh, I was so busy at college, I couldn't make it happen as a DJ, and vice versa.
Mm.
And then actually Steve did say, look, you're never going to pass any exams. You're never going to be academic. Come and work at the record shop. You'll meet all the promoters and the DJs, and it will help. And he was right. And it was a big thing for me to do that, because I was like, okay.
You
and I jumped in, and
that
was, I guess, 93.
Mm-hmm.
And again, working there, we did meet everybody, and then we started to get residencies all over Birmingham. And you know, that, and again, the trips to Ibiza are continuing every year at this point anyway. But that's how it started locally. That was the general gist of what was going on locally.
Yeah, and was that the point where you actually started to look at this and think, I could potentially make this into a career? No,
you know, I was renting my decks two or three nights a week to a local pub. Mm. So I was being relatively entrepreneurial, I guess, looking back. And, you know, as a kid, I remember at that age, I was earning about 500 quid a week, which felt like more money than I could spend, it felt like. Yeah. But again, I still don't think there was a plan. I was just so consumed with loving what I did. Mm. And being obsessed with every part of it, I didn't think to stop and think about it. I was just very much in the moment of enjoying it and not really trying to make a plan.
Yeah.
You know, I remember having an ambition that could I be popular enough that I would be driving up and down the motorways of the UK DJing every week, you know, that yeah. I think that was a goal I had.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of the people we were booking at the time, Judge Jules, Alistair White, all these totally Dave Seaman, you know, all these people, that's what they were doing. That's what I saw.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's what it looks like when you're doing better. So, yeah, I had an ambition to be more successful. I didn't have a clue as to how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, DJs didn't need to make records to validate their existence.
Yeah.
Now they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, many years later, again, Phil Doherty and a guy called Adam Presdy, who were the commission, who were doing a lot of production work. They were doing stuff with Pete Tong, all sorts. In later years, Phil and a guy who was working in the studio called Alex Tepper became Future Shock and did obviously very well.
Yeah.
It was really hanging out with Phil at the studio. I loved going to the studio.
Mm.
So it was over in Selly Oak in Birmingham. And we would go there and Steve would go there a lot. I think Phil mixed Steve's first record, actually. And so I enjoyed that environment. Be hanging out there in record shops, putting parties on, handing flyers out every night,
yeah.
and very much being part of the scene, you know,
the
and
scene
enjoying.
And the
enjoying.
Culture. Yeah.
There was no plan. It was just, you know, other people had jobs. It seemed very dull and very boring.
Uh-huh.
And I was having a great time and I didn't stop to think, should I be doing this? I just didn't consider it. It was the only way I could see living, you know, of having fun.
Absolutely. And you know, you're living that life that's if you're getting rewarded for it and you're doing something you enjoy. I mean, you know, it's a win-win, right?
Absolutely.
So you're obviously synonymous with Ibiza. You're talking to me from your home in Ibiza right now. You know, from that kind of 90s period onwards, you know, you have the long association and residency with Cafe Mambo. How did you make that leap from becoming a success in the UK over into Ibiza? And you're already so familiar with the island anyway.
I mean, I wouldn't say we were successful in the UK. I mean, you know, we'd run a student night and I always feel that me and Stu felt nobody cared or was really bothered about us in Birmingham, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard to make an impact against the other people that seemed so, they were older and more connected. You know,
it's,
and it was like,
honestly,
we were on the outside for sure.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because he said exactly the same thing in our chat.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean,
he said no one from Birmingham and that area ever helped him in his career. He felt
neither of us or even really been involved in anything in general, actually, in the cultivation of what happened in Birmingham, because we weren't there.
Yeah.
You know, once our career started, they were 99% of the time it was just international. So you weren't. I don't think I ever played in Birmingham after that period, really. I don't think anybody ever cared that much from Birmingham. You're so local and you're part of the furniture that it's hard to really have an impact, you know, it was for us anyway. So I guess holidays to Ibiza continued, you know, and I guess 1991, I think I had a holiday with my friend Mike, just me and Mike went, and we went back to Café Del Mar. And that was Jose's first year. And I was I think I'd read in Mix Mag something about Jose.
Uh-huh.
And I went up to the DJ. It's quite, because I became very good friends with him and I managed Jose. But I went up to him and in my terrible Birmingham accent, probably said, I've been reading in Mix Mag, there's a bloke called Jose that plays it. Can I buy one of his tapes? Because it was a thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he just laughed at me and said, well, there's nobody here called Jose, but you can have one of mine. And I walked off and thought, is he taking the piss? It says Jose. I was thinking, whatever. But this tape was for me like listening to Sasha tapes.
Yeah.
It was like equally as impactful and I guess informed everything really since. You know,
yeah.
I as a DJ now, which is very much a hobby, I don't want to make anybody dance. I want to play music people won't dance to, in a way. And this was the more alternative side of what I would be coming to. But I was just obsessed with it. And again, continuing to go back, I would buy as many tapes as I could afford and totally obsessed with finding every record on them. And of course, back then, without Shazam, you know, it was a job. And around this period, the owner of Global Grooves, a lovely guy called Adam Johnson, told me he was going on holiday and could I make him a tape? We used to talk about music a lot. And apparently he loved, this tape was very inspired by what I'd been hearing Jose play.
Yeah.
And another incredible DJ from Birmingham called Nathan Gregory was working at Network, the distribution company for Neil Rushton. And I would go and buy my records, and Nathan really knows his music, a great DJ now still. So I was buying these great records and I put them on a tape for Adam, and Adam loved it. And he said, look, we're opening a new bar in Birmingham. We need you to be our main resident. I was like, wow. Yeah. And then actually quite quickly, they got Jose to play every month with me. So I was singing records. I'd be like, tape 22, third track, side B, and I'd start singing. I always remember very clearly, I've told other people, I had quite a laugh with him about it, actually, as I knew him in later years, but trying to sing Bob James' Sign of the Times to him, and him just being like, oh, God. And then he'd tell me, and then I'd ask him another one, and it was, it was too much information. I was being, but I desperately wanted to know what these records were. And then I think by the time we got to about 94, he put the Café Del Mar album out, which blew my mind. And at the same time, Lifeforms, Future Sound of London.
Yep.
So I was really getting into weirder, spacier, trippier, more alternative music. And, I was still massively into, again, at the same time where, because the timelines can blur, but, as Shelley's had stopped, Renaissance began, and I think Steve even arranged a coach for everyone to, we were all so into Sasha. It was a big deal in Solihull. If like Sasha was God in Solihull.
Yeah.
So we all went to Renaissance at Venue 44.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Mansfield. Wow. It was just, and then there's a guy called Mark Taberner used to play in the chill out room. So he'd be sitting down there listening to The Orb and, that kind of thing. And it, just fantastic. So, all of this is going on with, we're even timing our holidays in line with gigs Sasha would be doing, because we really want to hear him. So as much as I was massively into, I guess that would have been progressive, the early era of progressive house and a lot of that Italian stuff, which was really into, but at the same time I'm building a second record collection in a way, in a different direction. But I think when we got to about 94, again, amazing memories of, a lot of people would leave Café Del Mar after Sunset, but I really like what he played after Sunset, very melancholy house records, things like Paper Moon, 51 Days, and something on Laurent Garnier's label, DJ Gigi by Nova Nova, like these great records that just really struck me. Acupressure, We Are the Future, these kind of amazing records. And I would always stay in there and just, there was something magical. And I remember that era, it was a magical, like this, the sun had gone down, but the sky was lit up and this music matched that. And it was so emotive for me. I was really consumed by that. And, but then I think one of our mates, it was so busy in Café Del Mar a lot of the time that you couldn't get a drink. And one of our mates said, oh, look, there's a bar next door. There's no one in there. I was like, let's go grab a drink there and we can come back here. And I remember we went in and Sasha was in there and Carl Cox and all, Brandon Block. And we were like, oh, there's all these DJs in here and people we'd recognised. So we started kind of equally going to Mambo as well. And I think me and Steve used to hassle Jason By, who was the resident, for the names of records. And he was very friendly always. And Steve, being a bit probably cheekier and more outgoing than me, blagged to play some music there the following year, I think, in 1995. And I think went out for a couple of weeks. I don't even recall if I had the same holiday as him that year, but the next year, again, and at home, all the same things are happening. We're busy locally, and But then Steve called me one day while I was at my mum's, and he said, you know, when are you coming to Ibiza this summer? And I said, I'm actually coming tomorrow with my girlfriend. And he's like, I've got you a job at Mambo. I'm leaving. I've got some other opportunities. I've talked them into giving you a chance. There's a ton of people here he knows well.
Yeah.
But I've talked him into that you were born to play here, and he's got to give you a go. So I packed my records. Of course, I don't think my girlfriend at the time was too amused, because suddenly our holiday looked a little different. And I don't recall whether it was my first night or what, but I went to play at Mambo, and Steve left and just said, look, don't get smashed. Don't mess about. Just take it seriously. So I got there, got smashed, and, you know, and just the manager at the time was a guy called Miguel, who just seemed to just love what I did. And was such a supporter. And so I stayed for the rest of the summer. So I didn't actually go home.
Did your girlfriend stay with you?
Or? No, she was working for a stockbroker. So,
Wow.
No, she couldn't. And so again, that must have been quite difficult. But again, I was probably so consumed with like, oh my God. And I was very shy. I remember thinking, you know, there were a lot of people I knew because I'd been booking Brandon and Judge Jules. So I would see them and they'd be like, oh, you're that kid. Solihull. So there was a vague relationship, but it seemed like everybody was in these groups of friends, and I felt very much like I was there on my own. And I would actually buy a newspaper in the day, and I'd walk up to the first hotel we stayed in was near Hostel La Torre.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little viewing platform to the left of it where I used to sit. So I would, when I was younger, so I used to walk up there with the newspaper.
Mm.
I had a Walkman, a Discman or a Walkman, and I would listen to like Jose tapes, reading the paper. And I'd spend my days, because I had no friends. I was there on my own.
Yeah.
But that's how we got the job. And then, of course, my job was to try and make something of it. But that was how I got in, and that was 96 basically. Me and Steve basically shared that summer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Awesome. And, you know, so, you know, you like you say, you landed there, you become resident there, you know, you're playing all the sunsets.
10 hours a day every day as well. There's no day off.
It's that's insane. You know, firstly, what was your typical day of work, that 9-hour set? What preceded that?
The opposite of my current life. Like, I couldn't be less like my old self, thank God. But I mean, to not exaggerate, I used to live above Mambo's, or very close, depending on what year it was. I wouldn't wake up till 6 at night, very, very hungover, like really struggling.
Yeah.
And it would generally involve probably still not being late every day. I couldn't even get downstairs on time, you know. And being very blurry eyed. I'd have about 14 boxes of records in the booth.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd probably have a bottle of wine just to steady myself, which I would drink while the sun set.
Yeah.
You know, take 2 hours just to unpack exactly how I wanted everything.
Yeah.
And So I didn't have a day, as it were. I would be, maybe if I was up a bit early, I'd have time to eat, but often I would just eat while I was playing. But and then, you know, you'd get in, it would be daylight, I'd play relatively chilled, down tempo, mid tempo stuff, and get mellower and mellower. And I guess what differed with the way I did Sunset, and I don't know where it comes from, it's got to be inspired by Jose to a big degree, but I really got into playing a lot of movie soundtracks and a lot of films, sort of like classical music actually as well.
Yep.
Because it seemed the most emotive. And I always liked that hour before to really intensify the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It was probably reflecting on how delicate I felt myself, in fact. but, and then I guess the record pit, a lot of people refer to me as playing is, I played Pavarotti, Nessun Dorma, and it became quite a signature record of Mambo, really. And I was in a cafe once and there was a CD playing and it coincidentally came on at sunset. And I was like, oh my God, I got to play that. So you play the sunset and then you'd sort of bring it up slowly. I'd again, playing those very beautiful deep house records, pitch down.
Yeah.
And then you'd have a guest on and, you know, every night was we worked with Pasha quite exclusively. So Monday would be Roger Sanchez. Tuesdays might be Def Mix, Wednesdays Murillo, etc. Yeah. You know, the best DJs in the world are. So you're basically becoming friends week in, week out, which was something that could never have happened in Birmingham. These like stars you look up to, you became friends with and you got to play with, learn from. So that was happening. And then they would leave, I would go on. And Mambo was such a party at that point. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah. So and then towards the end of the night, I'd play jazz, funk, rare groove, a lot of sort of early disco, early hip hop. Just, I could play everything I wanted to play, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes I'd even play till 4 in the morning, you know, it was, and it, I guess the kind of DJing I'd been doing before, you played all night when you played. There was no guest, there was no culture of being a guest DJ. So you played for 5 or 6 hours. So to me, it wasn't an intimidating thing to play all night. It was actually fantastic.
Yeah.
But again, lots of drinking, a ridiculous amount of drinking every single night at Mambo.
Wow.
And then I would go out every night.
Yeah.
You know, to Amnesia, to Pasha, to everywhere. And, you know, I would sell a lot of cassette tapes. Some nights I sold like 30 in an hour once, a tenner a tape. I just go and spend all the money partying all night, every night. And then it might be Pikes for breakfast at 7 in the morning. And Tony would maybe sit with you and tell you crazy, crazy stories. And, you know, bedtime was lunchtime-ish or late morning. And that's how I lived for many years. But that's how everybody I knew lived. That was the culture. You wanted to go out and hear everybody DJing. And of course, very quickly, I would meet Jeff Oakes, who owned Renaissance. And, you know, I was always very, I've always been very good at visualizing and manifesting things without trying to. It's like a, you know, and I used to visualize a lot, how will I get a job at Renaissance? Because Steve actually got a job at Cream.
Yeah.
And our friend Claire, who was called DJ Heaven at the time, got a job at Ministry. And it was only the other big club was Renaissance. And it was my favorite club. And Jeff walked in one day and I was like, how can I? I was quite shy with people that were important to me.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to approach them. And I remember thinking, how can I get his attention? So I picked a record. It was High Bias, Drive It Home on Big Shop.
Uh-huh.
And he just ran over and was like, I've only ever heard Sasha play this. Who are you? And I was like, that worked. And I got very lucky. A guy who became one of my close friends, still is, who worked for Renaissance, seemed to really like my music. So he would always ask for tapes. And apparently Jeff had heard it being played at the Villa and had asked.
Hmm.
And then my mom was actually there one night. I turned around and Frankie Knuckles was watching me DJ. And I was like,
oh, my God.
And,
wow.
And my mom was there. And I introduced myself and then said, I need to tell you a story. And I told him the story about missing the business studies exam. And I have a signed copy of Your Love. I had it with me, you see, which I still have, of course.
Wow.
And again, when they left after the pre-party, Joanna, Jeff's wife, came back in and said, Frankie loved your music. Who are you? Have you got a tape? Yeah. And I gave them loads of tapes.
Yeah.
And then it happened with Rampling the week after.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, this keeps happening. And then in the end, Jeff just said, at the end of the summer, it was like, I want to give you a job. I can see you doing compilations for us and becoming one of our residents all over the world. And I was just like, are you kidding me? And Yeah, and I'm still great friends with Jeff now, you know. So, yeah, that led to becoming... So then I would start playing... I was resident at Privilege, Amnesia for them, at Space for them, at Pasha for them. And then I started being resident, I think, on the roof at Pasha for quite a few nights of the week, and then Money Pennies at El Divino. And I mean, I held residencies everywhere, I guess, in Space. Incredible. So it was a small community then. There weren't, you know, of the resident DJs, there was, you know, Jason Bai and Clara, who was called Miss Bisto at the time, and Griff from Manumission, John Ulysses. There was only a handful of working residents. So in a way, by being at one of the right venues, which I was, and I remember it was super cool and quite an industry hangout at the time, it got you that, you know, I remember playing at Manumission from relatively early on in the main room, and I was just like, wow. So you just pick those gigs up by being in the scene and being out and about. You know, you meet everybody. It's a small scene, Ibiza. So that's kind of how that got going, essentially. But that was a typical day. It was one long party, maybe once in a blue moon I'd get to a beach, but it was just immersed in nightlife.
Incredible. And, you know, like you say, you had all those 14 boxes at Mambo, and you were playing kind of a specific sound there, but then you're playing other gigs at other venues for other nights that all demand kind of a different type of sound as well. I mean, your record collection must have been huge.
Well, the thing is, I guess, again, as a manager now, you can't market someone who does that. It's almost like the biggest no-no ever. But I, as a you know, growing up, when you were the resident DJ in a club, you would have to play a bit of everything, in the sense that I would play a lot of acid jazz, soul, funk, disco, house. To me, it was all the same thing. You know, it was just music that had different energy levels for different times of night. So, and again, in that, and I guess hearing Alfredo and Jose and the other DJs in Ibiza, there was this, I wouldn't know that at the time, but it was very eclectic. And Jose used to tell me why it was that way. And a lot of the biggest records, a lot of the obvious records weren't imported because of the regime that was there at the time. Yeah. You'd have to find these sort of weird records and in bargain bins and put together, you know, this mixture of music. So I was very much into that. So yeah, I was able to play, you know, I used to play in the back room for Money Pennies in Birmingham and in Ibiza, and I would play rare groove, disco, jazz, funk. So play very much more of like a black music, like sort of from hip hop to everything. And that, to me, all those things went together. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I remember playing at a drum and bass club. I was very diversified. And I guess it was probably one of my bigger problems later on, was I couldn't pick one thing. I like good music, whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. I can't really divide into one thing and say, I only like this. I just wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah, as a music lover, it's tough to, you know, pick. You don't necessarily want to pick a lane or a genre, do you? It's really difficult.
No, I was always worried that I'd back the wrong horse, and then it wasn't driven by your own passion, and you were trying to calculate it, and it didn't.
And then you fall out of love with it quite quickly. It's easy to fall out of love with something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, just to rewind a little bit to Mambo in that time there, and you're learning your trade there in terms of playing a soundtracking a sunset, you know. I'm sure plenty of people listening to this and watching this right now have been to Mambo, listened to one of your sets, or at least heard someone's set at Mambo or Cafe Del Mar and Soundtrack Sunset. How do you guys get it so perfect with the sun hitting the horizon? Are you timing this? I need to know.
It's bloody easy if I'm going to ruin the magic. But
ruin it.
Maybe I should ruin the magic. Look, Jose didn't do that. It wasn't a thing. Like, I don't believe, I'd be lying if I pretended I was studying how he DJed. I was just consumed with the overall thing. But Jose didn't try and, he would just, wasn't a thing to try and end a record at that second. It was more reflecting the emotion of what he was seeing. And of course, in the period of the sunset, he would play a certain way. But I actually, on my first, you know, by the time I got to Mambo, I'd already bought the Cafe Del Mar albums. I'd bought the Future Sound of London records. I'd heard these down-tempo records, which was what was weird about Ibiza that Birmingham didn't have. At the end of the night, you would get those down-tempo records, or more, I guess, indie dancey type things, you know, things like Humba Humba, Voice of Africa, or they were played in a club in Ibiza. But I collected these kind of records, I guess, more Balearic records, or Elkin and Nelson, Jibaro, these kind of records that were a bit more, although actually that's a very lively record, but the Art of Noise records, whatever, you know, these things you'd encountered that you would hear in Amnesia in a club, and it wasn't weird, but you know. So I would be playing these kind of records, but timing it is, it does change on the time of year. When the sun hits the water, it's, you've got 3 minutes.
Okay.
It's pretty much exactly.
Yeah, no way.
So Pavarotti, coincidentally, is 3 minutes, 3 seconds.
Wow.
So if I start it when it hits the water, everyone thinks, wow, amazing. And what's beautiful about the version I had from, which was the live recording from Italia 90, it ends on a round of applause, which is 90,000 people clapping.
Yeah.
And actually, as people, this culture of clapping at sunset became a thing, that coming through the speakers made everyone think, wow. And it really created quite a thing.
Yeah.
So, but I got really into timing it because another DJ that played at Mambo called Dave Butler, he sat me down and he sort of explaining how he did. He was a really good DJ. And I think I watched him do it. I was like, oh, he's timing it. And he explained, you know, you could time it and you, this is how you would do it. So I got very into that. But I, again, it's not, I'd literally be like that with my sunglasses. I'd be like, the sun's there. It's there. It's about 9 minutes. And I'd have these little records that were filler records. So there might be 30-second interludes and I'd keep them in a pile. If I'd missed, because there was no loop. You can't just loop the record and time it. You know, I'd have to quickly go, oh no, there's a cloud. Is it going to come back out? If it is, I'll leave it. If it's not, I've got it. It's over now. So I would pull out all these different tools very quickly. We had three decks. So I'd have things on the third deck that I could quickly cut to while I got to the, you know. So I got very good at, and I was, again, very sociable. I'd probably be drunk, chatting to loads of people, not even facing the decks half the time. You know, I got very good at doing it fast because I was always, you know, being very sociable at the same time. So, yeah, and... You know, in all fairness, I remember when I sort of discovered a lot of the records, and more very recently, really that Jose was playing back then, because I only heard the records I heard him play and the ones that were on the tapes I bought. A lot of the records I was playing, he was playing years before, and I didn't know that. Whether culturally they were in conversations, there were no blogs to know this.
Yeah.
So it amazes me how a lot of those records were the same records, but I didn't know them directly, not very few of them anyway, but I guess, you know, there is a scene of music and dots join things on the same label, or, you know, I guess that maybe that's how a lot of that happened.
Yeah. And I mean, was that when you realized that there were those connections that you did, that suddenly kind of almost validate your own taste and give you confidence in terms of what you were choosing?
I mean, I guess you do copy the people who inspire you, but I guess your job is then, that you then go on and do what your thing. And,
absolutely.
You know, I definitely, you know, if I hear a record now, because I still obsessively buy vinyl, actually. And, you know, I if I hear a record I particularly like, I know instantly, you know, my sound is what makes me excited. I don't try and work it out. If you get goosebumps, it's your sound.
Yeah.
End of.
Yeah.
You know, it might be a slightly unusual techno record that's very atmospheric, or it could be like a Brazilian jazz album. It doesn't matter. I just know what I like. So you naturally, you know, I was also playing a lot of the records I'd heard in Ibiza early on. I was playing a lot of the records I'd heard in sort of bars in Birmingham, playing new groove, rare groove and jazz funk. So at the end of the night, Lonnie Liston Smith expansions, or Atmosphere Dancing in Outer Space, or Raw Silk Do It to the Music, or Dexter Wenzel, The Sweetest Pain, whatever. There was a place in the night where they felt right. And I guess I would, you'd see the view, it would make me feel a certain way, and that would inform my choice, I think, very subconsciously. You know, if whatever mood I was in was the mood of what was delivered. I mean, I remember, sadly, a few years in, one of the waiters had died in a car crash. It was very, a sad atmosphere. And I think so many people were crying. I played... So it was so intensely atmospheric, sort of emotional. I was like, oh my God, it was like, so it would come out in however you felt. And I liked the freedom of that kind of DJing. And now that DJing is not my job and hasn't been for quite a long time, the DJing I choose to do is where I have that freedom. I'm not,
yeah,
I'm not interested bizarrely in playing. I don't care what other people are. I'm not there to compromise. It's because it matters too much. So I play what I play, and you hope, of course, people like it. But that's stayed with me as the kind of DJing that I enjoy, is where you have that toke of freedom. And I, for me, when people are dancing, the freedom has gone. You've got to keep the dance floor, and that for me was limiting.
So it's a really interesting take on it. You know, I get that feeling of, yeah, when you have got people dancing, then it's like, oh, okay, I've got to keep these people moving, and maybe I'll go down this way, and it's not something necessarily that I would have wanted to go down.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. Exactly. So, you know, it's a very good segue into your current situation at Hostel La Torre. I mean, in terms of your musical director there, and you're very good at, I must say, you know, your Mixcloud is exceptional. Like, anyone who's listening to this, if you're not following you on Mixcloud, you know, the mixes you're putting up on there from the live recordings of La Torre are brilliant. You know, tell me about how that venue came around. I know, you know, in 2015 the Mambo Group bought it. You know, you said that you'd already aware of the building when you were in Ibiza in the 90s. Like, how did it connect for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was the first holiday ever, actually, in 87. It was near the hotel, so I remember sitting there because the view was great. I used to sit there when I was at Mambo a lot in the day, if I was up earlier, you know, I would sit there. But I think I remember Jose did an album launch there for his Navigator album in 2001, I think. And I went to that. So, and then I started going to La Torre with friends to watch the sunset. So maybe that was more on holidays later, after I'd left my initial, I did Mambo for 10 years where I was the only DJ there, essentially. The job wasn't a shared job. Like, now there's about three people a day. It was, you were doing the whole thing. And we used to go there for the sunset, and it, again, just unparalleled view. And I think, again, Jose played there a couple of times. But yeah, Javi bought it, who owns Mambo, and he just said, look, you know, you can run this if you like, you know, musically. And and I was like, yeah, you know, this is a great hobby. And again, that I was managing artists at that point. You know, I'd been a manager for 3 years, but I just moved back to Ibiza. I mean, I've been like a yo-yo back and forth constantly. I mean, this was a trip where I actually came. I was going to manage a guy called Mark Barrett, who's an amazing producer who I work with a lot now. But I came to manage him, and he had to leave the day I arrived. And I ended up renting an office. The friend who worked at Renaissance, Brett, who recommended an office, and actually met the woman who is now my wife. And I ended up staying for years. I wasn't meant to be at all. And so what I saw was, Javi said you can do what you want, and I saw an opportunity to do something no one had done before, which was put all the best DJs that I rated with no agenda of anything other than that I thought they were great.
Yeah.
People who I guess had always been into that, hadn't compromised on what, you know, people who really were into it, not I could do a chill out set, you know, somebody who's only ever done that. So I got, again, they happened at different times, but Jose, Alfredo, Pippi, Neil Macy from Birmingham, who ended up living there, John Satrincha, Fat Phil Cooper, Mark Broadbent and his brother Andy, who had run We Love and Cream, who'd run Pikes now.
Yeah.
So just put people in I thought were great. And sometimes I'd look at those lights, be like, Jose Monday, Pippi Tuesday, Alfredo Wednesday. I'd be like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, what a lineup. And and it was fantastic. And then, and Mark Barrett, I'd put in as well to be resident. We became friends. I guess I was managing Jose the year before, and I was at Mark Barrett's house very, very late one night. And he was like, why don't I sign Jose and we'll make an album?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, we could get all the best producers from around the world, like Tornado Wallace, who was new at the time, and Wolf Muller from Germany, and Telephones from Norway. We could do a writing camp in the winter and make Jose an incredible album. Like, you know, we could go do it at his house, get caterers. And so we had this experience there with Mark, which is when I first worked with Mark, and we made a beautiful album together called So Many Colours, which was Jose's last album, obviously, on International Feel, Mark's label. And so Mark became resident, but Mark had run a great label very, very well.
Yeah.
And his attention to detail is like nobody's I've ever known. And I work with Mark on a daily basis now, still. Yeah, he's incredible. And so it's like, well, let's do a vinyl album. Let's just do something really special. And so me and Mark set out to do this with Javi, and we set up a label.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one was so well received. It was incredible. So I guess we felt we were onto something, that people really enjoyed this. And in fact, that picture.
Yes.
I got this really hippie artist to design an idea.
It's making sense now.
That didn't get used, but I kept it because it cost about 600 euros. But that's the first template of what the album cover could be.
Yes, of course, yeah. So you're talking about the Hostel at Torre double albums that have been released since. Yeah.
Got a load of them down here, actually.
I've got some downstairs in my vinyl collection.
I wish I had more volume one. They go for about 100 quid
I
now.
I know. I tell you what, I miss volume one, and now I've got the rest, but I was like, should I get volume one? No.
We were asked to repress them,
mm-hmm.
and I spoke to Mark about it, and Mark ran International Four very well, and he said, let's not. The scarcity is a wonderful thing, and it makes it something special, and if we flood the market with them, you kill that. And it's
absolutely.
Like, as somebody who's, I've spent 25 years trying to find some records, and there's a beauty in keeping in that, in a way.
That sense of discovery when you find what you're looking
for. The bargain bin years later. Exactly. Yeah. So we did this album, and what was also, there was a real moment there, because what I started to do was, the other people that I would play probably twice a week, and everyone else, the guests, would play once a week. And I wasn't really rotating, because like Alfredo can do Mondays, Jose Tuesdays, I'll do Wednesday and Saturday. Like, I just, everybody had a set day, because it was easier for me to arrange it, and I was busy. I mean, that was the only reason. But and then I would start inviting guests on my nights, and that ended up being like Harvey, people I knew, or people had kind of me and Phil Doherty, that I ran that party with in Burton Solihull. We started a label, actually. Well, we started a music blog, because we hadn't worked together for a while and we wanted a reason to hang out. So we started a music blog called Secret Life, and it became a label. And then we managed Jose through that. And we put a couple of parties on at Pike's in, I think it was like 2013 and 14. You know, we'd bought, I don't know, we had Jose, Richard Norris, all sorts of different people came and played. And Leo Mas, Paul Daly, it was really good. But not super busy. But then the next year, actually, I wanted to book Greg Wilson, and he wasn't available. And his agent said, you could have Harvey.
Yeah.
And I was aware of Harvey. I'd loved Late Night Sessions, Volume 1. But I wasn't someone who was really aware and like a super fan. Like, I realized people were obsessively into Harvey. And I wasn't, just wasn't in my world that I'd encountered that much. And it ended up being that we could have Harvey every week. And that became Mercury Rising, which was became this totally bigger thing that incredible, which still runs. But so getting to know Harvey, he agreed to do our album launch, actually. So he came and did Sunset, and it was just fantastic. So then Harvey would play every year a couple of times, and you know, Leo Mas would play, who's just incredible DJ. I mean, like, wow, what a lovely guy. As well, Paul Daly was just in there one day, and I got to know him, and again, a lovely guy would play. So very organically, all these interesting people. And, you know, we even tried some big mainstream DJs playing alternative sets, like Radio Slave, Sasha. Maceo Plex did one, although we nearly had to kick him off. It was terrible. just didn't, I don't know what he was doing, but I think he thought he was at DC10. It was like,
oh no.
Lawler did one for us, you know. So we've had some mainstream people, as it were, doing that. But again, mainly a lot of more, I guess, in the more Balearic alternative scene, like Tornado Wallace and too many people to mention. But it became this really wonderful thing where DJs that I loved when they were on the island would come and play.
I've recorded
every set of anyone who ever played there. I've never put them anywhere, which is kind of crazy. Maybe I should, actually. You know, it's beautiful. I'm actually playing there, what does it say, tomorrow.
No, interesting. And you know, you have described the music that you're playing. It's not something that it's kind of like that anti-dance. It's good music, but you don't want people dancing. Like when you look out there and you can see a crowd, you know, and they're relaxing and having a drink and enjoying the moment. Like, you know, usually a signifier for a DJ, like we've mentioned, is I'm doing well because lots of people are dancing. If you're playing the type of music that you're playing, what signifiers are you looking for in terms of you're doing a good job? Or do you just like, I trust
if
myself?
I like it,
yeah.
Again, that can sound so rude and it isn't. What's the point in me not sharing what I'm into? Because then people can either value what you do or not, whether you know, if you bend to everybody's tastes, you stand for nothing and you don't represent yourself and there's no love for me in DJing records I don't like. It's not about, as much as I like the actual act of getting a record in time, I enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I wouldn't want to be a wedding DJ playing records I'm not into. That would hold no appeal to me.
Yeah.
So for me, it's about the records I'm into. So a lot of people, not a lot, you might get 10 people a night really as they leave going, wow, and they'll maybe reference a record or you can see I've really had a great experience.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, it's not super, super chilled all night. Like I really love a lot of Brazilian music. I love a lot of African music. I like a lot of, you know, I still play records from many decades ago. I love a bit of everything still. So, you know, and I don't mind playing familiar stuff that suits the genre that I'm coming from, but, you know, that connects with people as well, you know. So I guess the feedback is nice. It's very lovely. But I just think it's so obvious. They're there because they know what it is. It's on its own. It's on the end of a cliff with a panoramic view.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very clear that they want what you're doing because that's what it's... That was the point, was make it known for the music. Yes, we can sell great food, but the number one thing is always going to be the location there. Mm-hmm. But the number two thing for me was make the music the next thing.
Yeah. Awesome. And you've mentioned vinyl a lot and we've talked a lot about, you know, 14, 15 boxes at Mambo and things like that. What stage are you at with your vinyl collection? How do you manage it? Where is it? Is it in Ibiza? If you split between the UK and Ibiza? And...
You know, I've only got about 500 records here.
Okay.
I was actually back in Solihull last week and I think I got up to about 15,000 records because, you know, me and Steve also ran a record shop after we worked in Global Groove. So I got all the records at cost and I still spent all my wages on the records. They were my most valued possession, my record collection. I never believed I would sell a single record, but I just don't value my record collection as in the same way. Like I've now got it down. I keep trying to reduce it because you can't move that much weight and stuff around so easy. It's a problem, you know?
Yeah.
So there were a lot of functional records that were your set fillers while you were a functional DJ that I don't care about, even if they're fantastic records like a Peace Division track. But what am I going to do with it now? I don't, you know, so... And they are great records. They sound good now, but I don't require them. So, so I keep selling records. I've been selling some to a shop in Bromsgrove, I think. And then my accountant's been buying them off me every time I sell any now. But I've got it down to about 4,000 or 5,000.
Okay.
But they're in Solihull. They're not here. Yeah. I don't need them here, you know. And we've moved a lot, you know. We move a lot. I'm not attached to being necessarily stuck in the same place, so just to have that much stuff is a bit of a pain, unfortunately. I mean, so, and also buying records is complicated here because of Brexit, so I just had to switch record shops. I'd either buy from Rush Hour because it's obviously in Amsterdam, or buy from Fonica, and then if friends are coming over, get a batch brought over. Basically, I bought a load back, they're still sitting on my deck. That's from Fonica that was delivered to my mom's over the last couple of months. I'm generally away in Bali for a couple of months every year as well, so I'm ordering records while I'm there, and then they arrive and I go and get them on the way back.
Nice little present for when you get home.
Yeah.
And So how do you discover new music then that you enjoy? How do you crate dig?
Yeah, I mean, again, I miss, of course, driving around. I mean, I would drive up to Eastern Bloc one week and down to Black Market and Tag the next. That was very normal. I've been abroad to buy records, you know. But obviously times change, and record shopping for me is generally done sitting here in my office. Mm. You know, I'm super busy with my job, but I hunt for music every day. And, you know, I might share ideas with my artists who might flag a record to me and sort of play me stuff as well. But I there's a couple of music blogs I particularly look at. I love Paul Burns' Test Pressing blog. Mm-hmm. I think Paul's got great taste.
Yeah.
I did a show. I've been doing radio for years as well. So I had a show on Worldwide FM with Mark Barrett, mm-hmm. Which was the Worldwide Ibiza. And again, because I'm super busy, I only see what's kind of generally in front of me. And at that point, that wasn't in front of me. And then I discovered, I'd heard of Lou Kuna before, but I'd never heard him play. It wasn't something I'd been up to Manchester to hear him play. But when I heard his radio show, I was like, wow, we have the same taste. Like, I love every record he's playing.
Yeah.
And I discovered Antal from Rush Hour, mm-hmm. who had a show there. Paul does a nice show from Test Pressing on NTS.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them play, like, Antal loves a lot of Brazilian music.
Yeah.
Which I love. So I kind of learn and I pick up ideas there, and maybe that leads to, oh, what other albums did that artist do and what else is on that label? And again, and off you go, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
Paul plays a lot of sort of trippy, atmospheric, electronic-y, deep housey, super cool stuff. So again, I'll hear a lot of ideas listening to Paul's show and Luke's show and other DJs I hear, listening to mixes of other people, discovering music in my collection already that I didn't even realize I had. I mean, because I've got so many, I've got about 65,000 digitally, and I don't illegally download things, so and it's so well organized. But yeah, also Rob's blog, Ban Ban Ton Ton, is good.
Mm-hmm.
Other people's mix, I like listening to other people's DJ mixes, you know.
Yeah,
I'm Shazamming stuff, and I obviously in the winter in Ibiza, I'm not so much out and about, but I'm, you know, in the summer, I'm out every night Shazamming everything. And, you know, we just spent 2 months in Bali, you know, and I was at the yoga barn pretty much every day doing meditation retreats and stuff. And I'm hearing great music there, and I'm like, what the hell is this? And I, you know, wherever I go, I'm absorbing, you know, I heard a lot of music in the yoga barn, bizarrely, that would be incredible for sunset, you know, like a lot of more unusual music in that space. So I hear music everywhere. And every time I have a gap between meetings, I'm often discovering music, buying records, buying a lot of stuff on Bandcamp. I am as obsessed now in discovering music as I ever have been, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I have beautiful places to go and play it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I only play in a handful of places here, and that's enough. And I'm playing Bali at the end of the year normally, but I don't really even do other stuff. I enjoy playing in Ibiza. I don't want to fly around the world to DJ. I did that for so long. It's it's just, I can drive half an hour and play at La Torre or the Standard or Pikes or wherever, and it's I don't need to, you know I've got a life I love that I, you know, I have a full-time job with management that I'm loving as well, like obsessively love that. So
yeah,
you know, it's got to fit around everything else. And I did too much last year actually DJing, and I want to do less this year because it became like a job again, and I don't want it to be like a job.
This is the moment in the interview where we talk about the five tracks that you've chosen for our playlist, if we're talking about tunes and mixing things together and them having a place in your heart. We always have five different themes. It's called the House Culture Perfect Playlist. It's available on Spotify. Every single DJ has submitted five tracks from these themes to the playlist. So it's incredibly long, incredibly eclectic. We always start off with a catalyst. You did kind of mention this one earlier, which was off the House Sound of Chicago tape that your older sister gave you, and you've chosen Mr. Fingers' Can You Feel It? Beyond that, hearing it on that tape and reliving it over and over in your mind, have you ever had any special moments where you've played that out or you've heard it out and it's really taken you by surprise? Or
yeah, I mean, bizarrely, I've got about five copies of it. I don't know why. It was the vocal version, right, with Mr. Jack a cappella.
Yes, yeah.
In the beginning. But yeah, I've got so many copies of it. Yeah, I mean, I played it a lot after the sunset in Mambo. Mm. Mm-hmm. It's got that intensely melancholy, emotive mood. So yeah, it was one of those records that I would play after the sunset in that first hour. And I don't know if I heard Jose play. I don't know if I did actually. But yeah, for me, it's been played a lot at Mambo, like a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. And okay, so a floor filler. You've chosen Metro Area Miura from 2001, I think.
Yeah.
It was
on their first album. I can't remember the name of the album. It was the same album with Caught Up on it, I remember, which is the first one of theirs, I remember.
I know the label has got a number four on it, is the way I can visually picture it. I think
pink and white.
Yes, that's how my brain works as well. And this, you mentioned Luke Una as well. I've heard him on his radio show years ago play a version of this mixed with When Doves Cry by Prince, and it goes unbelievably well together.
They're in the same key. I can hear that.
Yeah, incredibly well. What's your experience with that track? Why is that a floor filler?
I heard that record for the first time. I think Ralph, the Italian DJ, played at Mambo, great DJ. And I heard it. I was like, wow, what is this? And it's just one of those records that's never left my box. Like once in a while, I do play to a dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it in Bali. I play at this resort in Bali every year, and I often do their New Year's Eve thing. It's normally like me and John Satrincher, and it's just one of those records I wheel out. It just works. There's something about that the kick and the clap speak to each other in such a beautiful way that it's like it makes you pull a face, you know, and you know when a great record is a great record because it does that. And yeah, it's good. That little string sample's very Sal Soul-esque, which is something I'm really into.
Yeah.
It's just cool. It's a great, it's a floor filler, and it's cool. It's understated, and yet it goes off, and it's a great record. And it's so well produced. It has not dated. It sounds good still.
No, yeah, it still sounds incredibly great good. Okay, Sunsetter, you have mentioned this one as well. The Pavarotti, Nessun Dorma.
It's just more dramatic than any other record. It's a very powerful delivery, and it really suits the sunset. If you nail the timing of that, it's incredible. I mean, I would only play that on a day where it was perfect looking, and you know, if the sky was a bit weird and dark, I'd pick something that would reflect that. But on those perfect textbook sunset days, that would be something I'd play quite a lot. I mean, and I don't really play at Mambo anymore, but on occasions I do, everyone's like, "You're gonna play Pavarotti," like. it's one of those records that I believe this makes it a very memorable. I was always aware when you're on holiday and you're young, you have those moments that made your holiday. And I always loved the idea that great music could create those for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had hundreds and hundreds of emails over the years. I still get them, normally from middle-aged men who are just reference a night in Mambo. And it's beautiful. Yeah. I love that. You know, it's really lovely. That's one of those records I think has probably created a lot of memories for a lot of people because it's just so powerful. It's great.
Funnily enough, it was when we interviewed Tall Paul, it was his choice for a sunsetter because he had heard it at sunset at Mambo. So
Paul was always in there, so
there you go. Okay, a tearjerker, Ennio Morricone, Deborah's theme from Once Upon a Time in America.
Again, that's a great example of a record. Apparently, Jose was very famous for playing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear Jose play that record, but I think the guy that taught me how to do the sunsets properly, a guy called Dave Butler, I think he taught. Maybe I heard that from him.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have picked a million records for that, really. But it's again Morricone stuff. I don't know how many times I played that record. Hundreds and hundreds of times. But all Morricone stuff, it's so emotive. Mm-hmm. Once Upon a Time in the West is another. I could have just as easily have picked that one.
Yeah.
But it's just beautiful. You know, it's one of those it's one of those records. I think if I was very fragile with a very bad hangover, that might just be like soothing me. But it, yeah, it's a beautiful record.
Yeah, I like his soundtrack for The Mission as well. I've heard Paul Oakenfold play that and reduce me to an absolute mess on the dance floor one time. Anyway, so yeah, your last tune, you've got a signed copy of it. It's Frankie Knuckles, Your Love, we've chosen.
What category was that in again?
That was the last tune. So a tune, the crowd are asking for one more. What do you play?
So I think it's really interesting. I just finished Oki's book, actually, this week. Phil, who I ran the club in Solihull with, said he'd put a book out and I read it. Mm-hmm. And it was quite interesting. So it seems that he got this idea of making a big thing of the last track was a Larry Levan thing, and I didn't know that. Uh-huh. So maybe I'd heard a lot of people who were inspired by that. It was always a big thing in Birmingham that there was a pause. You thought the night was over and you got one more. Yeah. And that record was often Frankie Knuckles, Your Love. Mm-hmm. But that was when it came out. That was 89.
Yeah.
And it was one of those records that the instant the first note plays, everyone in the room knows it's that.
Yeah.
And it's... I got to know Frankie very well over the years, and I had a chat with him once about the first record he made, and it was that. And I'm just like, you want to hear my first record? It doesn't sound like that. You know, as if that's your first record. It's like, you're kidding me.
Wow.
But yeah, and I remember there was before the Candy Staten record, the sort of the newer with the Candy Staten vocal over, there was a bootleg, I think, that Aaron had done, which was actually just the Candy Staten a cappella, the first bit of it looped.
Yep.
I loved that as well. I've actually lost my copy of that. But that was really special. So yeah, I'd grown up, that was a big record in Birmingham. It was it was the end of the night record. And I've always been someone who made a thing of the last record being, you know, a special record, and not just playing to the end of your set, stop, make a bit of drama, a moment, put something special on. And that was just, I mean, there've been others, but it was, I think, been more than any other I've played at the end of the night is that one. So, yeah.
And the precious copy, I'm sure, is sat in a sleeve.
I found it last week at my mum's when I was, I've got lots of great signed records, actually, I got a Dubfire signed, I think, the Junk Science album for me, and Kerry Chandler. I've grabbed them all over the years and signed that for me. So I've got quite a few. So, yeah.
Yeah, there've certainly been a few of these in-person interviews that I've done. I'm like, can you sign this at the end? It's a familiar tale on my part as well. We've had the last tune. This is the last question. You are obviously on the House Culture podcast. And when we talk about house culture, we're not just talking about the music. We're talking about the scene and the whole entire club culture that surrounds this movement. When you hear the term house culture and just look at the entire scene, including everything, you know, where do you see your place in it and what does it mean to you?
I've done I guess my position in it, I mean, it's hard to perceive your own position in anything, but I've done a lot of different things in a lot of different areas. But I think I would definitely be best known for someone who plays Sunsets in Ibiza, which is I'm very happy to be remembered or seen as that. Mm. And my place in it now as a manager is I love, you know, I get to work with super talented people and I get to, you know, be the other side of it, but with the awareness of being an artist. So I feel like I can see it from both sides as well. Loving my part, very much invisible behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I have no desire to, I don't miss any of that at all. That's the thing I didn't like. I don't want to be on show. I like being invisible in the background and I'm there behind my artists and they do what they do, you know. So yeah, I mean, I've found a way to stay in the industry, I guess. I one day, overnight, I decided I didn't want to do it anymore, which was New Year's Day 2012. Mm-hmm. I just felt I wasn't learning anything new. It wasn't evolving. It was the same thing over and over. And within a week, someone asked me to manage them and then and here I am. And it's a beautiful thing. I always knew I wanted to do what I loved and to, you know, I was 50 recently and to still be doing exactly what I love is an amazing thing. You know, that was the key goal when I was younger was spend my life doing something I love. And, you know, that. So I'm very lucky I've managed to do that so far.
Here you are. Well, that's a perfect place to end. Thank you so much. That's
thank you.
Amazing.
Amazing. Superb. Enjoy your weekend.
You too, Pete. Cheers. Bye.
House Culture.
What a ride Pete took us on there, and it's so pleasing to hear that he's in a good place professionally, although it all just sounds like great fun, doesn't it? For those craving one of Pete's eclectic musical journeys, you can of course catch him in Ibiza, playing at one of his many residencies at either Hostel La Torre, Pike's Hotel, Six Senses, or the Standard Hotel. And if you're not lucky enough to make it to one of those places in person, you can always catch up with Pete's sets on his Peerless Mixcloud page. You can also follow our own Perfect Playlist on Spotify that features submissions from all of our esteemed podcast guests. Links for this are in the description, and you can now also find all of our guests' Perfect Playlist selections curated as individual playlists over on our brand new YouTube channel. So don't forget to subscribe over there at youtube.com/houseculturenet. Please drop us a note of support in the comments section of whichever platform you're listening on, and also leave us a review on Apple or even drop us a message on Instagram. Feedback fuels our creative fire, and we will always aim to respond personally. Plus, you might just hear your name as a shout out in a future episode as well. This is why I'm saying hi to Jesse Perez off of Instagram, who dropped us a note about our episode with Steve Lawler, telling us that Steve's Viva Warriors parties at Sankey's in Ibiza were next level, and that he's so glad that he got to experience them. Aren't we all, Jesse? Thanks for stopping by, keep on listening, and spreading the word. That's all for now, but remember the essentials. Follow this podcast, subscribe to our YouTube, and please come and visit us at HouseCultureNet on Instagram. You can also stay in the loop by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. And for direct contact, hit me up on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.